The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good morning, everyone. Welcome to IMC. I would like to make one announcement, in a couple of weeks, on the 14th of June, we have kind of a special day-long event with a teacher from Portland named Gregory Kramer, and he's been a very interesting pioneer in the with the insight practice, in that he's taken the teachings of Theravadan Buddhism, the insight practice we do, and applied it to meditating in speech, to be mindful in speaking, in relationship with people. And I think he noticed that sometimes people who do insight meditation spend a lot of time with their eyes closed, not relating to others. And so to explore how the value of this practice can arise in relation to other people has been his passion for many, many years, and he's developed a whole series of retreats and a whole approach for working with that and working in dialogue and talking. And so it's kind of special. He's come here a few times before, but he'll be here, I think, on the 14th of June. And then in about 3 weeks, on a Sunday, after our regular Sunday program, I think it's the 23rd of June, we're going to have a community meeting. We don't often do community meetings. We don't have anything particular we have to talk about, so that's good, I guess. But it's good to meet in a different format. And so we'll, after the Sunday morning, we'll meet in the outer hall and maybe have tea and sit in a circle and talk about issues related to IMC as a community of practitioners and hear from you some of your concerns you might have or questions. So I'd like to talk today about a remarkable discourse, sutta, from the time of the Buddha that lays out some of the useful foundations for engaging in kind of wholehearted or intense or practice of meditation or the spiritual life. And in relationship to Gregory Kramer coming, you'll see that the first foundation for engaging seriously in spiritual life is having good spiritual friends and companions. So being in a relationship with others. It has to do with a story of a monk by the name Meghiya. And Meghiya was the Buddha's attendant for a while. And the discourse doesn't say this, but I think it enhances the feeling of the text if we imagine the Buddha is quite old. You know, he's maybe close to 80. And maybe an old man like that, wandering around India, it was good to have a companion. To kind of younger monk, maybe quite young, who helped with some of the things that needed to be done. And so Meghiya one morning, said to the Buddha, this would be a good time for me to go off on my alms round. And so to walk into the local village or town and collect the food he's going to eat for that day, because monastics, that's the only food the monastics eat in that tradition, is what people give them that morning. So the Buddha said, please, go and do your alms. And it's possible, quite likely, that Meghiya was also responsible for going, collecting alms also for the Buddha, this old man. So going to town, get the food, and come back, they'd eat it. Still to this day, in countries like Thailand and Sri Lanka, they have this custom. And so on his way back from town, Meghiya was walking, I think maybe along the river, and he came across a beautiful mango grove. So maybe you can imagine a mango grove. Mangoes have big canopy, and it's probably somewhat cool in a hot air, hot country, on the edge of a river, maybe a nice breeze, very peaceful. And it occurred to this young monk, this would be a great place for me to practice meditation. So he went back to the Buddha, And after their meal, Meghia said to the Buddha, "I found this wonderful place by the river, this mango grove, and may I have permission to go off into the grove to practice meditation for the day?" And the Buddha said to him, "This is not a good time. Why don't you wait until another monk comes to be my attendant?" And so Meghia says, that's the second time, he says, with a little argument, he says, "Well, you know, you've already done, completed your practice. You're enlightened and spiritually mature, and, you know, you've done what you had to do. But I'm still a young monk, and I'm still need to practice. I want to practice. And you know, this is a great place for me to practice." And the Buddha said, "You know, not now. Why don't we wait until another person comes, another monk comes?" And then Meghia said the same thing a third time. And the custom, apparently in India, or at least in the Buddhist circles at that time, was if you ask the Buddha something three times, he acquiesces. So he said, "Please, you know, if you need to, please go." So Meghia went off down to his wonderful mango grove in the river and started meditating. And after a while, he noticed that he was obsessed with lust, thoughts of lust, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of cruelty. And then he said to himself, and I love this part of the text, he says, "This is amazing. This is awesome. I, who am seriously committed to the practice, I've had the conditions here to go off and practice seriously, it's amazing. My mind is filled with lust and ill will and cruelty, thoughts of cruelty." Isn't that lovely? That, you know, rather than saying, "Oh, shit. Oh, shoot, you know. I'm just a rotten, no good, lousy person with these terrible thoughts. And, you know, I'm a Buddhist disaster. And, you know, it's embarrassing." He says, "It's amazing. Isn't this something? You know, this, we could all take a lesson from that. To be amazed and in awe of the power of our minds and what goes on, and how our, you know, we have the intention to do one thing, but our mind has another idea. Isn't it amazing?" So he goes, so he realizes it's not working to meditate, so he goes back to the Buddha. And he says to the Buddha, "It's amazing, sir. It's quite awesome. I've intent and serious and with the conditions to practice, was beset by lust and ill will and thoughts of cruelty." And so then the Buddha says, see, you get more or less right here. The Buddha says, "When the mind of freedom is not yet mature, there are five things that lead to maturity." So in other words, he's going to say that if you're not really free yet, free enough to go and practice on your own, there are five things that lead to that maturity, that ripening. And before I tell you what those five are, I would like to kind of recategorize them or interpret them as five great tasks that any human being should engage in their life, maybe as a foundation for in Buddhism for freedom. And the first task is the task of belonging, to feel some connectedness and belonging. People don't feel some sense of belonging to a community, to a place. It's a little bit hard for them to find their way in life. The second is a sense of integrity or wholeness, to feel whole or integrity or have a sense of worth because of one's personal integrity. The third is to be happy, to have some basic happiness in one's life. The fourth is to have a sense of purpose for oneself. And the fifth is to have some deep understanding of this life we're living. So these are important tasks, and some people have some of these. Few people have all of them, but some people, it becomes really important to work on one or more of these areas, because without some of these brought to a certain level of maturity, certain level of strength, there's kind of a hole in a person that makes it hard to do the kind of deep spiritual work that Buddhist practice is pointing to. And so sometimes it's necessary to actually take care of these other things first before going off on retreat or doing, you know, really long intensive practice. And so the Buddha says, you know, there's five things that lead to your maturity. So he's going to lay down the foundation of what was lacking in Maggia's practice, why he couldn't meditate. So the first, the Buddha says, is to have good spiritual friends and companions on the way. So to have other people who are models of practice, who can support you in practice, who can be guides in practice, who can walk the path with you. And it doesn't mean that you have to have a lot of people, or it doesn't mean they have to be kind of intimate friends with people. But it's very hard to do this path when you're doing it alone. And some people I know in this environment, when they are the only person that they know in their circle of colleagues and friends who meditate, they can feel like they're the odd person out. And it's a somewhat common conversation I have with people who come to me and say, before I started meditating, I was just happy at work, at the coffee tea area, you know, with the conversations that were happening there. But after meditating for some time, I just couldn't have those conversations because basically all we did was gossip. And I can't do that anymore. And so it's kind of awkward. What do I do? Or some people feel like, you know, everyone else thinks you're weird because you meditate and you like to be quieter than you used to be. And so it seemed kind of strange. One man many years ago came to IMC, an older man, I don't know how old, maybe in his 70s, who had grown children. And he came here for a while and he meditated for, I don't know how long he was meditating, that took up meditation. And then he came to me and he said, my kids are really worried about me. And they're worried because I'm not the same person. I'm not behaving the way they're used to me. They're behaving and they think something must be wrong, neurological problems or something. You see, I spent a lifetime being nervous. And now that I'm meditating, I'm no longer nervous. all the kids knew was this nervous parent, right? And something must be wrong. Dad's not nervous. So anyway, to have other people, whether it's a meditation group that you go sit with, and just the fact that you see other people who meditate can be meaningful, and you realize that you're not the only one who's strange. There's more other strange people. It can be helpful. But also to have people to mirror you. I think it was very important for me in my practice, especially in early years of practice, to be around other practitioners who are more further along than me, and to meet them and be mirrored in them, to see myself in them. Mostly I saw, you know, a lot of my attachments and attachment to sense of self and how I tried to present myself to them to make an impression. And so a lot of things, kind of social games I was playing that these people didn't participate in, and so I got to see myself more clearly. It was very important to see people who were more, who had practiced their sincerity and dedication and their hardness of their practice, their maturity, because there were times where it was hard for me to continue doing the practice. And only by having other people around to inspire me did I keep going. There were people who pointed out some of my faults, some of the challenges, some of the ways I was a little bit off. And without those pointing out, I think it would have been much slower for me to do this path. So there's many ways in which having good spiritual friends operates. Again, you don't have to be good, you know, really good, intimate, conventional friends with people. When I was living at the monastery for 3 years, I didn't really have really good friends there. It's more like everyone was my friend. It's more like everyone was a part of my village. And so I felt kind of connected to everyone and had plenty of social time with people. But it was the way practicing together with people and the kind of exchanges we had were very meaningful for me, even though that wasn't the group of people that I was really close to. So the first thing the Buddha said is to have good spiritual friends or a community or companions along the way. The second is to be ethical, to develop one's virtue or one's integrity. And then I like the word integrity, partly because it kind of means one, maybe, and to become whole. It's my belief that the lack of integrity is a lack of wholeness. When we do things to intentionally cause harm to others, we're not whole ourselves. We're disconnected to ourselves. There's holes, gaps in who we are. And if we want to, it's very hard to be unethical towards other intentionally if we are whole ourselves. Because in that wholeness, there's a sensitivity, and both to ourselves and to others, that just doesn't make sense to intentionally cause harm to anyone. And so the task of becoming whole, becoming whole in such a way that we know ourselves, that we feel complete in ourselves, we're not disconnected to ourselves. I think probably some of you will recognize how easy it is to do something that later you regret if you're harried and stressed out. You're in the freeway, rushing, you're late, fuming, well, everything's going wrong, your car's overheating, and you're trying to get someplace, and someone cuts you off, and it's very easy to do something with your finger. But if you're calm and settled and relaxed and you don't feel in a hurry, probably you just kind of take it all and kind of take it all graciously that someone cut you off in traffic and you're sitting there and it's hot. So the state of our mind is very important. So how do we feel whole? How do we feel connected to ourselves in a way that we feel whole or have integrity so we live ethically? So ethics is very important as a foundation. Without it, there is probably no Buddhism at all. So the third foundation is to be happy, what I call to be happy. This is how the Buddha words it. It's connected to having good spiritual friends. One obtains at will, with no trouble or difficulty, talk that is effacing, talk which is a help in opening up the mind, which conduces to complete letting go, peace, direct knowledge, enlightenment, and nibbana. So it's kind of nice. So hopefully you come to IMC, and it's relatively easy to get here, and or you go on the web. Nowadays, I mean, it's so easy to hear talks. You know, it used to be in the old days, you had to walk for, there are stories, you know, from the 1940s, in Thailand, of practitioners who walked for weeks and weeks in the jungles and the hills of northern Thailand looking for a great teacher so they can get teachings from that teaching. And now you just have to kind of plug in your iPad, and they're all kind of, almost every center now posts their Dharma talks, and, it's so easy to get hold of. So back then it was particularly difficult, so be able to easily hear these talks. But this is interesting. So it's basically easy to hear Dharma talks. That was also a time when there were no books. So what are the important things to hear if you hear a Dharma talk? Are you supposed to hear the metaphysics of Buddhism or the philosophy of Buddhism? Here is what you should hear. Talk about fewness of wishes. Talk about contentment. Talk about seclusion. Talk about being non-gregarious. Talk about putting forth effort. Talk about virtue. Talk about concentration. Talk about wisdom. And talk about freedom. What do you think of that? Fewness of wishes. Contentment, seclusion, non-gregariousness, putting forth effort, virtue, concentration, wisdom, and freedom. So in the way I categorize this, has to do with becoming happy. Some basic level of happiness. These are things that are conducive to becoming happy, to be content. There's a way in which there's appropriate contentment with one's life. And probably all of you have the experience of being unhappy because you are discontent. So in some aspect of your life is not up to what you want, and you wish it could be other ways. Even though you have all that you need, you have your basic necessities taken care of, the unhappiness has to do with things that are on top of that and greater than that. There's another story in this book here. It's called the Udana, about monk who is sitting in the forest, kind of in a forest monastery, so the other monks around. And he's sitting there meditating, and then the other monks suddenly hear this monk yelling out, "Oh, what happiness! So happy, happy, happy." And so the other monks look at each other and say, oh, we know what this guy's up to. Before he came to the monastery, before he became monastic, he was a wealthy in the royalty. So he had a lot of wealth and he was a royal person. And he's remembering how much happiness he had having all this wealth and all this stuff and all this servants and everything. And he's remembering it. He's decided now to disrobe and go back. So they go to the Buddha and they say to the Buddha, you know, you can't believe what this guy happened to this guy. He said, happy, happy, happy. And he's this, you know, and he's remembering his lay life as being a wealthy guy. And he's probably deciding to go back. So the Buddha said, well, ask him to come see me. So he goes. The Buddha comes to see him, and he says, you know, when you were meditating in the woods, did you say happy, happy, happy? And he said, oh, yeah. And why did you say that? And then this is the answer. Formerly, sir, when I was a householder and enjoyed the happiness of royalty, within and without my inner apartments, guards were appointed. Within and without the city, guards were appointed. Within and without the district, guards were appointed. But, Reverend Sir, although I was thus guarded and protected, I lived fearful, agitated, distrustful, and afraid. But now, on going alone into the forest, to the foot of a tree or to an empty place, I am fearless, unagitated, confident, and unafraid. I live unconcerned, unruffled, my needs satisfied, with a mind become like a deer's. I don't know, what's a mind like a deer like? It's a footnote. So it says, as a deer living in a forest where people do not travel stands and sits and sleeps confidently and goes wherever it wants, unimpeded in its movement, so I live. So that's why it's mind like a deer. Seeing this, Reverend Sir, prompts me on going to the forest and meditating to exclaim, ah, what happiness, what happiness. Isn't that nice? So he has, you know, as monastic, he has fewness of wishes. And so how being content, having few wishes, having a simple life, being virtuous, developing wisdom, and sometimes, you know, very different approach to life than how some people live their lives that end up filling their lives with more desire and fear and protectiveness and concerns around them. So the Buddha said, you know, that's a third foundation to prepare oneself for spiritual maturity. And then the fourth one, which is to have a sense of purpose, I call it that, one lives with effort aroused for the abandoning or letting go of unskillful states and for acquiring skillful states. So in other words, one begins to have a sense that there are, a sense of purpose, that there are some ways, some mental states, some states of mind which are useful to have and some which are not useful, some which are helpful and not helpful. That Buddhist word is skillful and unskillful. And to have a sense of that differentiation. And then to know how to let go of those states of mind, those activities of mind, which are not helpful for you, and to cultivate and develop those which are helpful for you. This is not meant to be something complex or analytical, or you have to acquire, you know, read lots of texts about what you're supposed to do. But as we become more sensitive through mindfulness and more aware, it becomes, I think, at some point quite obvious that certain states of mind are constricted, they hurt, they're limiting, they're darkening, there's obstructing, they don't help us, don't support us in our lives, they help us to make choices we don't want to make. And other choices and other states of mind lead us to be happier, lead us to make wiser choices, lead the mind to be open and sensitive and more like a deer, confident in the jungle. You know, it's like, you know, the rush hour traffic example before of, you know, if you're harried and upset and fuming, that you can feel that's not a helpful state of mind in. If you want to, you know, you can make all kinds of mistakes that way. A helpful state of mind is a mind that's calm and relaxed when you're driving and open and attentive to what's going on around you. So that's the fourth foundation. To have a sense, I call it a sense of purpose. And the sense of purpose is not an abstract purpose. It's not like you have to read a philosophy book about what the true purpose of human life should be. But there's something that can arise from a deep connectedness or a sensitivity to ourselves that provides us, shows us the purpose of life here and now. Because it's so obvious. If you step on a nail with your foot, the purpose right then is to take the nail out. That's pretty obvious. And I think that sense of deep purpose can come from a deep kind of knowing or intuitive sense to our life that, and, you know, and that comes from being settled in ourselves and connected. But anyway, it's one of the purposes, one of the tasks of most human life, some sense of purpose. It doesn't have to be the grand purpose of Mother Teresa or some big thing like that, but there's some without some sense of purpose or some sense of direction, many people flounder in their lives. And then the last one has to do with understanding. I think that there's a need for the human mind, human heart, to have some sense of understanding this life that we're in. And without some understanding of this life we're in and what's going on, people can feel lost, can flounder, don't know which direction to go. And the understanding that the Buddhist tradition points to is that understanding that leads to freedom, to liberation. A liberated heart, a heart that's at peace in itself, at rest in itself, no longer anxious, no longer nervous, no longer caught up, no longer... A heart that's at rest in itself. The understanding that provides that provides one of the greatest understandings. You don't have to understand physics to have a settled, relaxed heart. There's no need to say that Buddha, you know, to people don't do it so much anymore, but periodically there's been these books written on how the Buddha and physics teach the same thing. And so, you know, you have to kind of, you know, if you think you have to understand Buddhism now, you need to kind of get into quantum physics. But it's not that difficult to understand, you know, what it takes to have a settled heart. And so, but to understand that and the value and the importance of that. So the Buddha offered these five things to Maggia. This is what's needed. So I've known people who have gone off on retreat to do long intensive retreats and had to leave the retreat because there was some aspect of life that needed to be taken care of. My colleague and friend, John Travis, and maybe you've heard his story, he was on a long retreat and in India, and he felt some big obstacle come up, and he wasn't making any progress. It wasn't happening on his retreat. And so Ramdas was in India at that time. He knew him back. So he went to Ramdas and told him what was happening. And Ramdas, listening to it, said, you need to go back to Kentucky to see your father and reconcile with your father. So John Travis cut off his long dreadlocks that he had and went to a tailor in India and got a corduroy suit made, and then went back to Kentucky to see his dad. But Ramdas said, go back and see your dad, but don't stay long. So he kind of went back into his father's world and kind of reconciled with his dad, and then he went back to India and continued his practice. So sometimes, an example of, you know, sometimes we have to kind of take care of certain things. And I've known people also who've kind of beat their head against the wall trying to meditate because they thought, somehow they got the message that meditation can take care of all your problems. And so just have to try harder and do more. And it doesn't work that way sometimes. Certain things certainly can be addressed through meditation. Meditation is very powerful. But to expect everything to be addressed through meditation is not accurate. So here are these five kind of foundations for spiritual maturity that the Buddha gave Maggia, I think are a nice kind of reference point to reflect on and think about your life. And are some of these areas of your life areas that could use a little more attention? So they can support you more as you go along. Can you have more spiritual friends or better spiritual connection to other people? Can you work on your virtue? My assumption is all of you are virtuous, but my assumption is for all of us, this probably can be improved somewhat. What's your level of happiness? Are there ways, are there behaviors, things you can do, simple things to make yourself a little bit happier being more content? And maybe, certainly here the idea is you listen to Dharma talks, make you happy, to inspire you. But I think the idea is not just to be keeping inspired, but to actually follow through on some of these ideas. Discover how to have fewness of wishes, how to be content, how not to be gregarious in a way that just, is not happiness producing for anybody, including you. And then to know, to have a sense of what's skillful and not skillful, what's helpful and not helpful, to really have a sense of that. And then to cultivate those things which bring understanding. And traditionally, in our tradition, that comes from meditation. The deeper understanding of what helps liberate the mind is what unfolds through meditation itself. It doesn't have to, but that's where it is. So what do you think of all that? So do you have any comments you'd like to make about Maggia, or about the Buddha's comments, or about yourself?
I have a question, and that is that, do you think that if you attend to all five, that it really contains everything in your life in the end anyway?
I suppose it's pretty thorough. Are you trying to get away with not meditating?
No, that hasn't worked so far.
It hasn't worked so far. No. It feels pretty thorough, and so, and also, the idea that you would put off meditation until all these things are done is probably not so useful. These are integrated, they work together. So this is kind of one way of laying out a path, or it's not, or a comprehensive picture of what it means to be whole along, in this spiritual path. Yes?
I want to ask this question carefully. It's about the non-gregarious approach to being happy. And I've seen folks who are sort of becoming serious about spiritual practice.
And they get serious.
Oh, boy.
Yes.
And I understand not being falsely gregarious, but the non-gregarious and the straight face, the dourness, the looking throughness, they...
I used to have a great upside-down smile when meditating.
Yeah.
Let it just be a transition they have to go through, maybe. Sometimes when people are finding a way, they need sometimes to let the pendulum swing in order to find their way, and it is pretty serious work. I mean, the need some people have for practice is really huge. I mean, the degree of suffering and challenge that people have in their lives, some people have, it's just, it's really over the top. And so it is a serious thing for them. And so so they might have been actually, they're just as serious before, but serious with their depression or serious with their grief or something. So it's not a crime to be overly serious. It's just sometimes a drag for everyone else. And but I would be generous to them. And partly because if they're doing a mindfulness practice, something that allows them to really see themselves, it's self-correcting. It'll work itself out. And I would just be generous and just, let it be a transition time and way of finding themselves. And don't judge the whole tradition by those people. Remember the guy who was yelling out in the forest, happy, happy, happy. Can you do it when you're sitting? Yes.
Could you say more about the fourth one, purpose? At the end, you summarized it by saying skillful, choosing skillful instead of unskillful acts. When you were speaking of it earlier, it seemed broader and more defined than that.
Could be, yeah. So I think for some people the sense of purpose in life is the big hole, the big lack that they flounder about, and they're trying to find themselves, to know what they're about, and so without some resolution of this issue of purpose, they keep floundering in their life and get kind of lost. And so, you know, different people find different sense of purpose for their lives, and there's different layers or different ways of understanding purpose. It can be multiple purposes at the same time, multiple levels of purpose. The ultimate purpose that Buddhism offers, you know, for the Buddhist practice itself, is liberation and freedom. And some people find that to be extremely meaningful purpose. That's more meaningful than anything else they can do. It's their biggest contribution to the world is to support the movement of liberated heart. And it's enough to give them a really clear direction and that sense of purpose. Other people, maybe it's very important, but it goes together with doing some other work in the world, of being of service, that gives them a sense of purpose, or something else goes on. So because of the Magiya, as a monastic, wanting to practice and meditate, I think for him, to have a clear sense of the purpose or direction that he was supposed to go was necessary. And some people will meditate and don't have a clear sense in meditation, what it's about and what they're trying to do in meditation. And there's not a few people don't really understand that meditation is supposed to help you have a relaxed and or a mind that's at ease, and so they strain. One monk recently I heard talked about when I first started meditating, I thought I had to suffer more in order to become free of suffering, and that didn't work for him. But you know, it took a while for him to realize that. So the idea that some people don't understand, so they go in the wrong direction. So bearing down, being angry, being too dour and serious, you know that they actually may be reinforcing habits of mind which are not useful. So to have some sense of which direction to go. And that's why these talks about self-effacement, contentment, fewness of wishes, non-gregariousness are kind of like pointers in the direction that's helpful to go. Not that we have to kind of, you know, end up being, I don't know what, just, you know, silent sages who don't want anything at all. But the direction of that, and to go in that direction, such a way can be happier and lighter and more open. I saw Bruni before.
Something stirred up when I heard you talking about belonging and spiritual friends. So there are many questions, so I really don't know what to ask. The image that I see in my mind is this pendulum going back and forth and smiling at it and seeing the mind wanting to cling, wanting to anchor to some place. And part of me, you know, there's another thought that says, you're kidding me. It's like, are you kidding that? But in a sense of, it's just these bubbles coming out from this pool of, and I think I mentioned something about that yesterday.
Bubbles of attachment in your sea of peace.
Yes, and it's not a clinging to fix it or to make a difference. It's is where's the balance of belonging like this, belonging in a place of spaciousness and not belonging like this, where I feel oppressed.
Yeah, that's a good one. So how to what's a healthy way of belonging? The sense of belonging is a real sore point for some people. Some people feel they don't belong at all anywhere. They feel excluded. It's been remarkable to be in all kinds of groups, and everyone thinks everyone else belongs. You know, everyone thinks I'm the one who doesn't belong. You know. And I've known people who've been central to a group, and everyone sees them as central, like the pivot of it. Then you talk to them, I don't belong, you know. I feel like if they find out, if anybody finds out who I am, So the idea of inclusion, exclusion, it's a very painful one. And if you're excluded, it feels painful. If you're included too much, it's painful. Sometimes, it's where do we fit in this kind of whole thing? So working that out and finding one's peace with that is very important. So you're saying that you have some capacity now for peace, and in that capacity, you have these bubbles of suffering that bubble up that are still connected to the idea of belonging or not belonging, and where does belonging, sometimes belonging is oppressive, and I'm happy to belong to my group of friends, but I can't belong anymore to my family, those. Going home to my parents, just too difficult. And it's oppressive, So they think I belong, but please. I'll live on the other side of the country, then I feel okay. So that's an interesting question. So I think we should stop. You think it's short?
It's medium.
Medium. Maybe you'll get a very short answer then.
Maybe so. I see a lot of connection between these five things. Yeah. And back to the gregariousness, when I'm in a more gregarious mood, I feel like I'm more connected with people and I'm more, I'm happier. And when I'm not feeling so gregarious, I'm more likely to be isolating and not so happy. So hearing that gregariousness is not okay is not very appealing for me.
Well, good. So I think what you anytime you read these words, you have to take words lightly, even with the words of the Buddha. I mean, after all, they're in translation. Probably multiple, it's like telephone game, right? That's been going on down through the centuries. So, what do these words really mean, especially in English? And I wish I had beforehand looked up the Pali for you and been able to tell you what the original word is. Maybe gregarious is not the best translation. So you always have all these words, all these ideas. There's a context for them. India, 2,500 years ago, different culture, different times. It might have meant a whole different thing than what we understand it to be. So you don't want to get depressed or take any of these teachings too heavily, like, oh, this is the truth, this is how it is. Now I'm supposed to be non-gregarious. The Buddha said it, And what did he mean by gregarious, Just don't take it, free yourself from that kind of burden. But this is what you can do. You say, well, this word gregarious, I'm not sure what is meant here, but this word is supposed to be, is offered in a way that's, there's something about this concept, or some concept connected to it, which is meant to be helpful and supportive for my growth and maturity. In what way can I understand this general concept so it's helpful for me? So that's the question for you. I'll offer you. So what way is this general concept that kind of fits into the idea of gregariousness, or what way can you understand it so it's helpful for you? I'm expecting an answer.
I didn't think we had that much time. So.
You're not off the hook that easily.
I could see a type of gregariousness that would be, I would say, unskillful if there's a lot of, you could be gregarious at a party after four drinks or something. That probably wouldn't be very skillful. So I could see it. I could also see gregariousness if it's kind of trying to be the life of the party or people pleasing or what have you as being unskillful too.
So I think the more useful approach many times is to hear teachings. So how is this useful for me? Because sometimes it's very easy to see how it's not useful. And then to limit yourself from benefiting from it, because you actually don't benefit very much by saying this is not useful very often. You get much more benefit by saying, well, probably there's ways it's not useful, but how can I make this particular teaching useful? In what way? How can I look at it? What angle? What perspective? And maybe it's only like, maybe from now until, you know, for the next 50 years, maybe it's only going to be useful once. You know, this non-gregarious thing. But that one time, it's really meaningful. So, you know, so this, like, when is it useful? What circumstances is it useful? And in what way can I understand it? I think it's actually a more, I just think it's a more helpful way of approaching this. And you have the freedom to do that. You know, you don't have to be oppressed by Buddhism. You know, then you get too serious. Okay? So, thank you so much.